All right. So the next matter we have on for argument today is case number 83213, Lee versus Patton, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. We do have counsel here in Carson City for appellant, and I believe we may have counsel in Las Vegas for the respondent. Is that correct?
Yes, Justice Kadish, we do.
Okay, great. So with that, let's go ahead and proceed. I guess before we start the arguments, I would note that our order setting the argument specifically noted the issues that we were concerned to hear about today. And so with that, appellant, would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Okay, so just so we're clear, when you get down to 5 minutes, the yellow light will come on and there'll be a tone, but the clock will keep running, and it will keep running as long as we keep going. All right, go ahead, please.
Very good, thank you. May it please the court, Prescott Jones, on behalf of the appellant and counter-respondent, cross-respondent, Tan Vinh Lee, is Justice Kadish, you noted before, the court's invited oral argument today on mainly two issues. One, whether the challenged offers of judgment are ambiguous, and if they are, what is the proper way for the court to interpret those offers? I'm going to start with the issue of whether or not the offers are ambiguous, and I'd like to draw this court's attention to a case cited by the respondents in their supplemental brief, the Gilardi case, case of this court's, which, to put it briefly, states that in speaking of contract interpretation, a contract is ambiguous if its terms may reasonably be interpreted in more than one way. And I'll submit to the court that this particular offer of judgment, these two offers of judgment, are a tale of two paragraphs, with one paragraph being the complete opposite of the other paragraph. Just briefly on the first paragraph of the offer of judgment, I'm going to refer to the offers of judgment just as a single offers. Quite simply, they're the exact same language.
Sure.
The first offer of judgment reads, in relevant part, defendant Ingrid Patton hereby allows to offer judgment to be taken in her favor only and against the plaintiff, Tan Vinh Lee, in the above entitled matter in the amount of $1,000. So the offer of judgment by its terms here states that the judgment would be entered in favor of the defendants for $1,000 each. The second paragraph tells a very different tale. Second paragraph reads, in the event this offer of judgment is accepted by the plaintiff, Tan Vinh Lee, defendant Ingrid Patton will elect to pay the amount offered here within a reasonable time and obtain a dismissal of the claim. So this is really, it's the polar opposite of what we're seeing in the first paragraph here. Mm-hmm. We're saying in the first paragraph, judgment is going to be entered in favor of the defendants, but in the second paragraph, the offer is saying that the defendant is going to be paying money to the plaintiff. So by the terms of the offer of judgment, the defendant is going to be receiving a judgment in her favor, but paying money out to my client.
Mm-hmm. So, counsel, which raises the obvious question, was that ambiguity or inconsistency ever raised before our order setting this argument?
Well, the entire discussion at the district court level when the order was entered on the attorney's fees, the entire discussion was about the ambiguity as it related to the computation of attorney's fees and costs that were incurred either by right. my client or by the defendants, the respondents. The ambiguity has created a host of issues, including the one I just mentioned. But the ambiguity underlies the entire motion practice at the district court level and the briefing before this court.
So what should we do with that? I mean, if I credit the first paragraph of the offer, what's happening is the plaintiff can pay $1,000 or $2,000, since it's doubled, to get it, to have judgment entered in favor of the defendant. So in essence, the plaintiff loses plus pays $2,000 out of his pocket. The second paragraph says the opposite. And so it's quite ambiguous, but I don't see anywhere in the record that that ambiguity was raised. And so it makes a difference, because the plaintiff ultimately loses on summary judgment, recovers nothing. If the plaintiff had to pay $2,000 out to get out of the suit, he beat the offer of judgment. But if he didn't, all your other arguments come into play. But it makes it very difficult for the court to analyze this, even from the get-go, of whether the plaintiff actually bettered his position by proceeding with further litigation.
Well, correct. It's a confusing situation, certainly, that is the creation solely of the respondents in this case, of the defendants in the underlying case. There's not an easy answer as to what the court has to do with it or can do with this. My client submits that this is an invalid offer on its face, simply by virtue of the fact is, for example, in this court's opinion in Nevada State Education Association, which is cited, I believe, in the supplemental brief, says that this court has to undertake efforts in terms of contract interpretation to avoid an absurd result. And I'm not sure how you allow this offer of judgment to stand or to be valid without producing what would, quite frankly, be an absurd result, where judgment would be entered in favor of the defendants, but the defendants would be paying my client $2,000 collectively. So the only answer I think that this court really has to come to would be that the offer of judgment is invalid. It has to be thrown out. It shouldn't be considered by this court, and it certainly cannot form the basis of the award of attorney's fees and costs that were entered by the district court.
Okay. What do you do with the general rule that appellate courts don't usually sua sponte consider arguments that weren't raised and resolved in the district court and presented in the briefs on appeal? And there are three main exceptions to that. One, if it goes to jurisdiction. I don't see this one does. Two, if it raises a constitutional issue. And again, I struggle to fit this in that framework. But three, maybe the plain error. If there's plain error in crediting this offer of judgment, perhaps that could be argued. Is that what you're arguing?
Well, correct.
That the district court committed plain error in crediting this as you yourself read it?
Correct. There's sort of, I think, two parts to my answer to your question, Justice Pickering. First is that, yes, this is certainly plain error on the part of the district court in allowing what should be considered to be an invalid and certainly ambiguous offer of judgment to form the basis of the award of attorney's fees. We saw in, I believe, the Elbios case that this court, sua sponte, allowed prejudgment interest made a ruling sua sponte to allow prejudgment interest on, I believe, attorney's fees, even though that wasn't raised by the briefs in that were presented to this court. But with that said, again, the ambiguity issue forms the entire basis of the opposition to the motion for award of attorney's fees at the district court level. It forms the basis of the entire argument that was submitted by my client to this court. And somewhat surprisingly, the discussion at the district court level turned on a different issue. But again, what underlies everything is the ambiguity.
Hasn't your client's position throughout the district court proceedings and the proceedings before this court been that the defendants offered to pay us $2,000?
Well, correct. And I think the second paragraph makes it clear that the defendants did offer to pay us $2,000. The issue, of course, and the ambiguity is how the judgment would be entered. And by the terms and conditions of the...
If your client understood that that's what was being offered, what's the effect of the ambiguity? I mean, you're not claiming that that impacted whether your client accepted the offer or not, are you?
Well, it's hard to address that, I think, without raising some attorney-client confidentiality issues, but I can submit this to Your Honor, is that if my client were to accept this offer of judgment on its face, and let's not forget Rule 68A says that judgment is taken in accordance with the terms and conditions of the offer of judgment, then we have a result where, yes, my client understood that he would have to, under the terms and conditions of the offer of judgment, have to pay, or would get paid, $2,000. But also under the terms and conditions, as stated in the first paragraph, he would have judgment entered against him. So I don't think there's a lawyer in the state or the country that would ever advise a client to accept an offer of judgment in that form and potentially have judgment taken against him as a plaintiff in the set of facts. Now, it doesn't change the fact that my client's understanding, as stated during his deposition, was that he believed he was going to be paid $2,000 if he accepted the offer.
Counsel, why didn't you argue that to Judge Sturman, what you just said? I mean, or did you? I mean, our record indicates, we assume, and why we scheduled this argument was it was so confusing from what the judge did, how the judge read the offer of judgment, what was argued versus the way we read it, and we're trying to unravel this mess here. But so what did you argue to Judge Sturman about it, the language of it?
Well, certainly the discussion in front of Judge Sturman revolved around how to calculate attorney's fees as it relates to whether or not the offer was beat. My client's position was that his attorney's fees at the time of the offer of judgment being made in, my time is run.
You still have your 5 minutes, but
sure.
It's up to you.
Sure, I'll try to briefly answer your question, Justice Gibbons. The argument to the court was that the issue before the court, Judge Sturman, was whether you factor in the plaintiff's attorney's fees or the defendant's attorney's fees at the time the offer of judgment being made in order to figure out whether or not the offer was beat. That was sort of a, not a tangent, but a sort of an argument that stemmed from the underlying ambiguity. The record is certainly a large one in this case. There's no doubt about that, but
So you did argue it was ambiguous. You're saying that the offer was ambiguous.
Correct. Yes, ambiguity
with regard to the inclusion of costs and fees.
Well, correct. Yeah, that was the issue that ended up taking over the entire discussion and most of the briefing as well.
Right. But there wasn't an argument that it was ambiguous as to who a judgment would be entered for if this was accepted.
Well, correct. That specific issue wasn't fleshed out before the district court. Certainly.
All right. You want to reserve the rest of your time?
Thank you. I would.
Okay. All right. Counsel for respondent.
Good afternoon, Justice Kadish, Justice Pickering, Senior Justice Gibbons, David Snyder, on behalf of the respondents and cross appellants, Ingrid Patton and Ingrid Patton PLLC. This court promulgated Nevada Rule Civil Procedure Rule 68 to facilitate and encourage settlements. And I think this court has been clear that when faced with ambiguity in an offer of judgment, that this court can look to the events that happened subsequent to the offer to try to determine whether or not ambiguity existed and whether or not the parties understood there to be ambiguity. Mm-hmm. As we noted in our supplemental brief in Fleischer versus August 103 Nevada 242, that Nevada courts properly construe purportedly ambiguous offers of judgment to try to determine whether or not the parties understood what was being offered and what they were risking in rejecting an offer of judgment.
But the problem is that Fleischer, the offer was accepted, and so the back and forth between the parties was a normal settlement contract.
Sure. Sorry, Your Honor.
But it's a different proposition when you have an offer of judgment that is foregone. The person rejects it by silence. There's no exchange between the parties. So you look then at the rules for construing an offer of judgment, which is a fee-shifting measure that runs against the common law, and therefore you construe the rules in the associated statutes strictly. And that's Quinlan versus Camden and other cases from Nevada and elsewhere. And looking at the law elsewhere, if an offer is so ambiguous such that you can't enter judgment on it, it then doesn't qualify to swing the fees and costs as penalties. It's not where you admit extrinsic evidence back and forth. I mean, I suppose if you had an exchange with Lee's lawyer after you sent the offer and you clarified something and he went ahead and accepted it on those terms before the 10-day penalty period ran, that would be one thing. And that was part of what was of interest in the setting argument. But I don't see anything like that. There isn't anything like that here. It's just they evidently misread it and you evidently misread it or deliberately ignored the problems in it.
Well, I don't know that the record before this court shows that Dr. Lee misread the offer of judgment, and I would like to direct the court to the actual portions of the record that demonstrate that they clearly understood throughout the litigation that Ingrid Patton was offering to pay $1,000 and that Patton PLLC was offering to pay $1,000 in order to resolve the matter. The court should note Dr. Lee's opposition to the initial motion for attorney fees and costs in the volume 9, pages 1,292 to 305. This issue doesn't come up. In same volume, pages 1,307 through 18, as opposed to the law firm, it doesn't come up. They file a supplemental opposition where they raise ambiguity in the offer of judgment, but only as to whether the costs were inclusive. They didn't raise the issue on whether or not they misunderstood who was taking judgment because it was perfectly clear.
Did you at any point address, do you agree with me that if you read the first paragraph by itself, it says that the plaintiff will have to pay the defendant $1,000 to get out of the case?
I think that you can read it that way, but I think that the second paragraph of this offer of judgment resolves any ambiguity within the first. And I think that we can use the four corners of the offer to construe any latent ambiguity that might exist within the first paragraph. And I think that's precisely what happened here. Dr. Lee's counsel understood. And again, I know I just went through the motion, but I think the hearings, both on the motion for attorney fees and costs and on the motion to reconsider, are incredibly telling on how Dr. Lee understood this offer of judgment, which this court will find in the ninth volume, pages 1,451 to 78, and then also on the motion to reconsider, 1,480 through 92. They never raised this issue because it's understood. And in fact, I believe they state as much, and as you know, Senior Justice Gibbon, he stated, Dr. Lee himself stated as much in his deposition. What I thought this court was alluding to be honest, was whether or not the offer of judgment included fees and costs, because that's what the parties raised. Whether or not they fleshed it out all the way, but that's what was actually contested below. I don't think this issue was brought up because it was clear to all the parties that Ingrid Patton and her law firm were offering to pay $1,000 in order to resolve the matter with Dr. Lee.
And the briefs parse this, your briefs as well as theirs, they parse it to recast the opening paragraph to run the other direction.
Well, Dr. Lee did not raise this issue in his opening brief.
Yeah.
And so I didn't address this squarely in my responding brief. I tailored my arguments to the arguments made by the appellant. And so that's not something that we fleshed out or dove into, I'm afraid. But I believe it was the appellant's burden to make that argument in his briefs, and he failed to do so.
I don't disagree with you. I guess the question I have is, what do we do now?
Well,
like, do we kind of make believe that this was clear?
Well, I think that we can take the actions of the parties subsequent to their offer and the arguments that they make and that they didn't make during the hearing on this motion and in their appellate briefs, and use that to understand that they never misunderstood what the object of this was with regard to who was paying money and who was taking judgment under NRCP 68. I think the more interesting argument is to resolve whether or not this offer of judgment was inclusive of fees and costs, and if so, whose. Unless the court has more questions on the ambiguity as to who is paying and who is taking judgment, which I'd be happy to try to answer. I would like to address that with what time I have remaining.
I guess I do.
Yes, Your Honor.
What rule should we, like, we have a writing here that to me is problematic. And if we're asked to write an order about this case, we need to refer to the offer of judgment and the fee shifting consequences that it has. There's a question as to who pays the $2,000 to whom. There's also a question as to who the judgment would be entered against. And in a defamation suit, that can matter also. So what should this court do with that threshold question? Because the two things, one, who did the offer say the judgment would be against? It can be read to say the judgment would be against Patton, or against Lee and in favor of Patton, and that Lee would pay $2,000. It can also be read the other way. There's law that says ambiguous offers aren't enforceable to shift fees. Should we get into that and treat it as plain error? If so, why? And if not, why not?
Well, I think that it's difficult to address plain error under these facts when the appellant didn't raise any of these issues and didn't give the respondent any opportunity to make these kind of arguments. And, you know, candidly, to the court, I prepared more for whether the fees were inclusive in this question. So I'm a little off the cuff, and I hope the court appreciates that.
Yeah, no, I understand
that. I think that in the context of what the court does with this, I mean, this is waived. This issue is waived. There's no record below. There's no argument below. It can't meaningfully jump in and resolve this issue by itself. Perhaps Dr. Lee expected this court and its staff attorneys to do its work for him, but that's not how it works in the appellate context. If this was apparent to them, they should have raised it. We would have put forth our best arguments, and at least this court would have had a robust presentation of case law to try to resolve the issue in a way consistent with our law. Whether or not any order that came of this would have precedential value, I'll note that NRCP 68G, the 1998 version, controlled this offer of judgment, and it fell into a neat gap where the legislature had repealed NRS 17115,
yep.
Which went into effect October 1, 2015, and had yet to enact NRS 17117. And so the precedential value of whatever comes out of this case, I think, is minimal at best, because now the court has both a new version of NRCP 68 and also construes that consistently with NRS 17117. But I, of course, I understand your concern with that, Justice Pickering.
There is a case out of the Court of Appeals, and I recognize that it's not citable, called Nieto versus Chandler. Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not,
okay,
Your Honor.
Then I won't ask you about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Pickering. I'd like to now, if I may, address whether or not this offer of judgment is inclusive of fees, and if so, whose. Had I raised this issue, and if I was representing Dr. Lee, I may have raised the last antecedent rule to suggest that that portion of the offer of judgment, which states that it is inclusive of, and then at the end, any other sums that could be claimed by the defendant, that perhaps you would limit that language to the last term, which would be other sums that could be claimed. However, there is an interesting exception to the last antecedent rule, which the United States Supreme Court recently addressed in Facebook Incorporated versus Duguid. And this is a newer case, and it's not in our supplemental authorities, but you'll find it at 141 Supreme Court Reports 1163. There, the court notes that under conventional rules of grammar, when there's a straightforward parallel construction that involves all nouns or verbs in a series, a modifier at the end of the series of the list normally applies to the entire series. This is called the series qualifier canon. It is in Reading Law by Justice Scalia Garner on page 147. And it's in Sutherland Statutes and Statutory Construction, section 44, subsection 33. And footnote 4 gives a lot of examples. And basically, here what we have is we have an integrated list that states inclusive of all, an adjective meaning every member or individual component that is going to follow, accrued interest, costs, attorney fees, and then here comes the qualifier, any other, which again is an adjective integrating this serial list. It notes that it's being distinct from the things mentioned prior that could be claimed by the defendant Patton. So we would argue that the plain applying rules of statutory construction to the fee section in this offer of judgment demonstrates that it was only inclusive of the fees that Patton could claim against Tonvin Lee. And this is consistent with the arguments that defendant's counsel made below in the district court, which I'll direct this court's attention to. We can find in the hearings in volume 9, pages 1,460, 1,474 to 75, and 1,485.
I think you're correct on that. I mean, I think I agree with your reading on that, that you're saying that the plaintiffs can't include the plaintiff's fees and costs in that.
Yes, yes. And so any ambiguity, and again, just figuring this is the issue that they raised below, and this is the issue that they raised in the brief, so this is what I came prepared to argue. So I would say in this context, it's clearly offer of judgment didn't include Dr. Lee's fees and costs, or excuse me, his costs, because that rule only allowed for costs. And therefore, he did not beat the offer of judgment. And the district court's award under Rule 68, therefore, was appropriate. Alternatively, even if this court were to conclude that the language of the cost provision included Dr. Lee's costs, he still didn't beat the offer of judgment because the controlling rule at the time didn't include attorney fees. We have to apply the rule as it was, as it states, and this court is routinely in a line of cases remind the district courts that you may only apply Rule 68 as it's written. Boyer versus Tack comes to mind, and also Nuremberger Hercules Work GM BH versus Virus Tech. In both instances, the district court went outside of NRCP 68 and considered fees, costs, or interest outside of what the rule permitted. And this court said you can't do that. You have to stick to the plain language of the rule.
I have one more question that's just a bit different, but it concerns the court's Beatty analysis, Judge Sturman's.
Yes.
And she says at page 7 of her opinion, she finds that the suit was not brought in bad faith, but then she gets to the third factor and she's analyzing whether it was in bad faith or grossly unreasonable to reject the offers. And she says that defendants offered plaintiff an early opportunity to take judgment against them. And that gave me pause again against the text of the offer, because as I read the offer, it doesn't allow that. Plaintiff would not have the sort of nominal victory of an offer of a judgment in his favor against the defendants. The offer of judgment runs the other way in the first paragraph, or it would have been a 68D dismissal if you read it the other way and he was going to pay the money. So under no circumstances would the plaintiff have had an early opportunity to take judgment against the defendants. And is that a problem as far as the district court's Brunzell-Beatty analysis, that appears to be incorrect?
Well, what I can say, Justice Pickering, is that it would certainly be a problem had this issue been properly raised and put before this court. I will direct the panel to the appellant's opening brief, pages 18 to 22, where they get into the district court's Beatty analysis, and the only Beatty factor that they challenge within their opening brief is the second one, whether the decision to, whether Patton's offer was reasonable in timing and in amount.
Yeah.
They do not raise any issues with the third Beatty factor of whether the decision to reject was unreasonable. They raise it for the first time in their responding brief on pages 7 through 8. At that point, of course, we do not have the ability to respond.
Yeah, the reply brief. Yeah.
We had to limit our reply brief on cross appeal to our opening brief on cross appeal. So, you know, candidly, Justice Pickering, this is something that we would have liked to have fleshed out had we been given the opportunity. But again, appellants did not meet their burden on appeal in raising this issue before the court. And this court normally doesn't consider arguments that are raised for the first time in reply. Seeing that my time is up, I will be seated unless this court has any further questions. Thank you.
Prescott Jones on behalf of the appellant and cross-respondent Tanvin Lee. These offers of judgment were so ambiguous, so poorly drafted, poorly worded, that the district court judge and both counsel involved had differing readings of the offer of judgment throughout the entirety of the case and the appellate process as well. That type of ambiguity and that type of confusion that offer of judgment creates is exactly why this offer of judgment should be found to be invalid and certainly not used as a basis to support such a large award of attorney's fees. Counsel mentioned during his argument, talked about the four corners of the offer, and I think that's an important distinction that I want to point out here is that we're not talking about a contract here. We're talking about an offer of judgment that wasn't accepted. We don't have, of course, the elements of a contract. There's no acceptance here. My client wasn't involved whatsoever in the drafting of the offer of judgment, the wording, its effect, nothing. And I think that's why, as Justice Pickering pointed out, I believe she mentioned the Byers case. I may be incorrect on that, but certainly the McCrary case refers to the Byers case and says that in the context of offers of judgment, ambiguities in the offer of judgment are construed against the offeror, which is the respondent's patent in this case. And I think this case presents exactly why that's a situation here in Nevada, is because my client had no control over the offer of judgment. He was presented with a Rule 68 take-it-or-leave-it offer. My client elected to not accept it. So I think it's a problem that's a creation of the respondents that now want to use or have used that offer of judgment to successfully get an award of attorney's fees at the district court level. I also want to briefly address the argument that my client understood during his deposition the terms of the offer of judgment. And again, I'll direct the court to the fact that my client only discussed the payment portion of the offer of judgment. His understanding was that he was going to be paid $2,000. What he was never questioned on was who the judgment would be entered in favor of. He was never questioned as to the validity of the offer of judgment. He was never questioned as to any of those issues other than he believed he was going to be paid $2,000.
And doesn't the offer of judgment itself express Patton's intention to pay the money rather than have any judgment entered?
In the second paragraph, certainly. And I think that's the issue here and the ambiguity is that tends to contradict what I think a typical person would see reading the first paragraph, which says judgment is going to be entered in favor of.
Well, doesn't every offer of judgment say you offer to allow judgment, but then you can reference the part of the rule that allows you to pay it before judgment actually gets entered?
Oh, certainly.
Routine, isn't it?
Certainly, absolutely. The offeror certainly had the right under Rule 68 to pay the judgment early, paying dismissal of the litigation, but the issue that my client faces, if he accepted that offer of judgment, he's not necessarily guaranteed to get that payment in a reasonable time and may have to attempt to obtain a judgment in his favor as against Patton. Now, if that scenario played out, my client accepted the offer of judgment, payment wasn't made in a timely manner, he had to get judgment against Patton, he has no basis to get that judgment under the terms and conditions of the offer of judgment as presented to him. He has no recourse at that point.
I know our time is about up, but I want to ask just one question, which is about the issues that are raised in the briefing, mm-hmm. and specifically, so as to Rule 68, and I'm going to talk about the version of Rule 68 that was in effect when the offers were made, and I'm looking at 68G, and it talks about, and I think what you're relying on is the sentence that would say where a defendant made an offer in a set amount which precluded a separate award of costs, the court must compare the amount of the offer together with the offeree's pre-offer taxable costs with the principal amount of the judgment. So I lied. I actually have two questions. So first, what evidence is there in the record of what your client's pre-offer taxable costs were?
There's no evidence in the record of that. The record focused on, of course, the attorney's fees that were incurred by my client at that point in time, and that was again, recognizing that 68G at the time in 2017 contemplated only costs, but we still had 68A, which said the offer of judgment is based on the terms and conditions of the offer. One of the terms and conditions of that offer related to the attorney's fees that were incurred by my client, were incurred by the respondents. Either way you look at it, that's a term that the offeror decided to put in their offer of judgment. They decided to include it, and that, again, under McCrary, has to be construed against the offeror to the extent it creates an ambiguity.
Well, one of the arguments your client is making is that under this part of the rule, I understand you were talking about the later version of the rule, but that what you add together to compare whether your client bested the offer or not, right?
Correct.
Okay. So then my second question is, under the terms of the rule itself, so you have to compare the amount of the offer together with the offeree's pre-offer taxable costs with the principal amount of the judgment. And even under the later version of Rule 68 that it talks about fees as well, it talks about the amount of the offer together with the costs and fees. Is your interpretation that that means that you take the amount of the offer and subtract the amount of costs and fees to compare that with the actual result in the case? Because together with doesn't usually mean to subtract something.
Well, I can't see any other way to interpret the offer of judgment as written by the offeror other than having to subtract the attorney's fees and costs that my client incurred up until the point of the offer of judgment, subtracting that from the offer of judgment to figure out what the actual offer is for the purposes of comparison. Otherwise,
so every offer of judgment to be valid has to be for an amount more than the offeree has already incurred in fees?
To the extent that the offeror specifies that the offer is inclusive of the attorney's fees of that party, of the offeree, it has to be. Any other reading of that, I think, would render that language simply be ignored at that point. We have to consider, again, the terms and conditions of the offer as drafted by the offeror. If they want to,
I'm talking about interpreting the rule, not the offer judgment right now.
Well, correct. Yes. 68G, I understand where Your Honor is coming from, certainly.
So, if I assume that your argument is correct and that the offer precluded a separate award of cost to the offeree, we assume that that's true and that's the way the offer judgment reads, then this lays out the comparison that has to take place. Compare the offer together with the pre-offer taxable costs, and let's even assume it said fees, with the principal amount of the judgment. The amount of the judgment is zero, and now we have $2,000 together with costs and maybe fees. Wouldn't the together with make it a larger number, not a smaller number?
Well, to the extent that the offer, and again, this is where we run into issues with the ambiguity, to the extent that the offer would contemplate my client's attorney's fees and costs as the plaintiff, if the offer is going to be inclusive of his attorney's fees that he may be entitled to, I think the only way to read that would be to subtract the attorney's fees that he incurred at that point in time from the amount of the offer judgment for the purposes of comparison. Again, okay. This issue is, again, the creation of the offeror and the way the language was drafted in that. So,
okay.
Justice Kadish, I have an additional question, if I might,
sure.
on this issue.
Yeah.
I'm trying to understand your argument about inclusive of attorney's fees and costs. You're looking at the language in the first paragraph of the offer after the number 1,000. Is that right?
That's correct, Justice Pickering.
And so, in your argument, what is your argument for including your? I guess you're saying already that it's flipped, that the 1,000 is running the other way, and so inclusive of interest, attorney's fees, and costs that could be claimed by defendant and against plaintiff. What do you do with that language in your argument that we should include your fees and costs in the baseline measure?
Well, there's sort of two ways to answer that question. One, if we assume that there is an ambiguity and it was intentional in that the offeror intended to have judgment entered in their favor, then we have an ambiguous offer of judgment that should be rejected by this court on simply because of that fact. If we're going to assume, though, that that the offer of judgment actually meant that judgment was going to be entered in favor of my client, then it would follow, I think, that it would be inclusive of my client's accrued interest, which would make sense as the plaintiff, of my client's costs and my client's attorney's fees. So with that in mind, then I think you have to, in order to figure out what the actual value of an inclusive offer is, you have to subtract his accrued interest, costs, and attorney's fees incurred at by that point in time from the offer to figure out what the real value is to my client.
What do you do with the phrase that could be claimed by defendant Ingrid Patton against plaintiff Ton Lee?
Well, that's the ambiguity sort of rearing its ugly head again here, is that if you accept the arguments of the respondents that what they really meant is it was supposed to be a judgment entered in favor of my client as opposed to their client, then I'm not sure you can consistently, or for the sake of consistency, say that the cost could be claimed by defendant against my clients. They had no basis for attorney's fees. They had no basis for an award of costs, absent being a prevailing party. They have no basis for a claim of accrued interest as the defendant in this case. There was no counterclaim brought by the defendants against my client in the underlying district court action. So there's no basis for any of those claimed entitlements.
They had brought an anti-SLAPP motion that had been denied but was on appeal at the time, correct?
Correct. I believe it was, I'd have to double check the time on that. I believe it may have been decided prior to, because I don't believe there was anything ongoing in the district court action at the time the offer judgment was filed, but I'm not 100% certain on that.
Okay. Anything else?
Did you file a motion for anti-SLAPP attorney's fees when they lost their motion to dismiss?
We did. We filed it in the form of a Rule 11 motion. Unfortunately, we weren't entitled under the statute at the time, and I believe still to this day we're not entitled to our fees and costs for successfully defending an anti-SLAPP motion.
Unless you show it was frivolous or something.
Correct. We did file that motion, correct.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel, for your arguments today. We appreciate you being prepared to talk to us today on fairly short notice, so thank you. With that, we will stand adjourned till the next